You are listening to Ithaca Now, WICB's weekly news program focused on stories in the Ithaca community. I'm your host, George Christopher, and thanks for joining us. On tonight's show, we'll bring you the best of Ithaca Now from the last 3 months. We'll return to the Ithaca Common Council as it takes up the city's latest rendition of reimagining public safety. We'll hear the sounds and songs of Cornell's Ornithology Lab, courtesy of correspondent Caroline Grass. But first, we'll look back at the Seneca Meadows landfill, as WICB correspondents Caroline Grass and Joshua Pantano break down its environmental impact. This is the second of a two-part story.
Last week in our story on Seneca Meadows landfill, we heard from activists and residents around Seneca Falls and looked into the politics and local tension surrounding the landfill. In this episode, we'll be talking about the environmental impacts of Seneca Meadows landfill, as well as alternative options for managing waste. Seneca Meadows is permitted to accept 6,000 tons of waste and produce 100,000 gallons of leachate daily. The landfill produces around 650 million gallons of leachate each year, and the processing of the harmful substance is one of the most contentious issues. When runoff water, usually rain, mixes with permeable solutes such as landfill waste, it produces leachate. While leachate can usually be processed in filtration plants, many landfills across New York do not have this capability, or if they do, they cannot process the volume of leachate that is produced. Leachate usually contains high quantities of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, more commonly known as PFAS. There are many different types of chemicals that fall under the label of PFAS. According to studies by the Centers for Disease Control, PFAS may cause negative health impacts, including increased cholesterol levels, changes in liver enzymes, increased risk of kidney or testicular cancer, and decreased vaccine response in children. According to Seneca Meadows' 2022 sustainability report, Seneca Meadows processed 37.1% of their leachate on-site. The rest of the leachate was transported off-site. Yvonne Taylor of environmental activist group Seneca Lake Guardian explained how wastewater treatment facilities often accept untreated leachate.
That's the problem, is that there are no regulations about PFAS chemicals and where you can send them and just discharge them. So, you know, wastewater treatment facilities all over New York State are accepting landfill leachate because I think what one of the problems is that these PFAS chemicals are kind of what they call an emerging contaminant. Like, nobody really knew about these forever chemicals and where they were coming from. So there was no real concern and no need to, you know, consider these chemicals. So there is no law in New York State that says you can't just dump it into our waterways and into our drinking water resources right now.
One of the sites that Seneca Meadows sends its leachate to is the Passaic Valley Sewerage Commission, located in Newark, New Jersey. Other sites include the Buffalo Sewer Authority in Buffalo, New York, the Steuben Lakes Regional Waste District in Bath, New York, and the Webster Wastewater Treatment Plant in Webster, New York.
So there are four leading causes of PFAS, and landfills are one of those. And, you know, when we look at Seneca Meadows, which is New York State's largest landfill, they report that they produced 75 million gallons of PFAS-laden leachate a year. And this leachate, there's only a third of it, as you mentioned, that goes through a reverse osmosis process, which takes some of the contaminants out, not all. And that portion is the stuff that goes through the Seneca Falls wastewater treatment facility. So it's sort of like they're trying to appease the locals by saying, well, your part of the leachate is quote unquote clean, which is not entirely true. But the remaining millions of gallons of this PFAS-laden leachate is trucked untreated all over New York State to Buffalo, Watertown, Chittenango, Steuben County, and some of it even New Jersey.
According to the Seneca Meadows 2022 sustainability report, leachate is contained by a liner system and then collected through a network of perforated drains, which would allow water to be released for further processing while trapping larger waste substances that have not yet dissolved into the water. A 2022 study from the U.S. Geographical Survey collected 254 samples from five aquifer systems across the eastern United States to determine the amount of PFAS found in groundwater that is also used as drinking water. The study found that 14 of the 24 different types of PFAS tested were detected in groundwater. Additionally, 20% of public supply and domestic wells contained at least one PFAS detection. The study also found that near certain locations, such as chemical manufacturing facilities and landfills, the quantity of PFAS found in groundwater was much higher. Therefore, towns and cities near large landfills would be more likely to have PFAS in their groundwater. According to Finger Lakes Times reporting, a study by environmental testing company Test America conducted in 2018 found high levels of PFAS in leachate originating from Seneca Meadows. In March of 2023, the Biden administration created new national standards regarding the amount of PFAS that are allowed in drinking water. The Environmental Protection Agency now additionally requires consistent sampling of PFAS in public drinking water systems across the United States. A 2023 report from the agency stated that since PFAS are commonly found in consumer products, landfills are some of the largest contributors of PFAS to the environment. The report also states that traditional methods for PFAS treatment might be unsuccessful. As part of the report, the EPA outlined plans for researching PFAS and figuring out other treatment options. The EPA stated that current treatment options for PFAS are limited and many conventional treatment methods are ineffective. Along with concerns about how these chemicals can affect drinking water, many activists, such as Taylor, have brought up concerns regarding air quality.
Air contamination is a big one, and you know, everybody on the planet should be really concerned about global climate disruption. I don't call it climate change anymore. It's definitely human-caused climate disruption. And landfills are responsible for 17% of all total methane emissions, which is, you know, a greenhouse gas that's 21 times more potent than carbon dioxide. So not only should we be worried about our water, our drinking water being safe, but also, you know, this is a major contributor to global climate disruption. And also, obviously, increasing the harmful impacts of respiratory illnesses with air particulate matter and unseen gases that can harm our health.
In November of 2021, New York residents voted in favor of an amendment to the state constitution that gives every New York State resident a right to clean air, water, and a healthful environment. Town Board Member Steve Churchill talked about his frustration over the amendment because he feels it doesn't apply to members of the Seneca Falls community who deal with the odor and adverse human and environmental health effects from the landfill.
I mean, it's part of our Constitution now, but it doesn't apply to Seneca Falls. You know, we have to breathe this stench all the time and nobody's doing anything about it.
Taylor also talked about how this amendment has started to be used in court as an argument against expanding or opening landfills.
Phenomenal amendment to our Constitution. So it's not even like a Department of Environmental Conservation regulation. That is our constitutional right now. And it was passed overwhelmingly among voters in New York. So we've been watching very carefully to see how is this going to be used to defend these rights. And as a matter of fact, there was a landfill ruling recently where a judge preliminarily said, this is a constitutional right. There is no questions, no ifs, ands, or buts. You must adhere to this constitutional right. And he upheld the argument that a landfill in the Rochester area was, you know, infringing on those rights of the community nearby. So we'll see what happens with that as it goes through the appeals process. But this initial ruling was extremely promising for any of us concerned about the environment.
Rich Swinehart, CEO of Waterloo Container, a bottling company across the street from Seneca Meadows landfill, expressed his concerns about odor and truck traffic outside the landfill.
First of all, there's always odor. There isn't a day where there isn't horrific odor from there. Some days, you know, worse than others. There's always dust. There's always seagulls with their bird droppings. There's always truck traffic. And a lot of the truck traffic, because it's coming from out of state or downstate, the trucks are in terrible condition. They're not safe to be on the road. New York State State Police, the New York State Environmental Conservation Police, and New York State Department of Transportation use one of our lots to pull in unsafe trucks and to inspect them and then to red tag them so they can't move. But now you've got a truck sitting on our lot leaking garbage.
A study conducted by Cornell University in 2008 showed that garbage trucks traveling through Ithaca, including trucks from Seneca Meadows, were the source of, quote, major safety issues as well as road damage, noise, and offensive odors. Barb Reese, community member and physics teacher at Minders Academy in the Seneca School District, said she feels the state is moving towards more climate-resilient policies, but that there's always more that could be done.
I think New York's policies are going in the right direction, but I also think that more has to be done. Especially, it's hard being in a small town like Seneca Falls. We are kind of at the mercy of this landfill that just keeps taking in trash. So I know there's always going to be a need for a landfill. I guess that's their argument. But what needs to happen is right now, Seneca Meadows takes food waste in with everything else, with the municipal waste that includes food waste. But so much of that does not need to go in a landfill. I feel like we could save landfill space if there were policies that forbid companies, because they are a private company, and they pretty much do what their company policy is. But if the state were to say, you can't operate like that, you can't take food waste and put it in the landfill, that would eliminate some of the odor we have, and it would save space for the things that actually had to be landfilled. It doesn't change the fact that it's outgrown the size and location of where it is here in Seneca Falls, but it would at least, I think, save future generations from what's going on.
The EPA estimates that 24% of municipal solid waste is food waste, which is more than any other substance ending up in landfills. Reese is on the town's Waste Management Advisory Committee and said they are trying to create an organic recycling program for the town to help lessen the waste the town creates, which is only just a small part of what the landfill takes in.
We're trying to plan for a future where we know where our waste is going and that we can handle taking care of it and minimizing what we need to send to a landfill. So we're trying, I mean, the town, there is a group that's trying to do the right thing, to plan for a time when the landfill is actually closed. I've been part of this group for a long time. And so we're hopeful that we'll be able to maybe someday have a you know, a food waste composting area that is just serving of our town or maybe our county. What we don't want is a large scale composting facility. We don't want to take in New York City's food waste.
Last month, New York City Mayor Eric Adams and New York City Department of Sanitation Commissioner Jessica Tisch announced a plan to offer free composting services that would not require a sign-up for residents in New York City. By 2024, yard waste, food scraps, and food-soiled paper products that are set out in a bin on a recycling day will be collected in the program across all five boroughs. Composting programs in the city have existed in the past, but never covered more than 40% of the city. Swinehart talked about how switching to sustainable products, like paper instead of styrofoam, and using reusable bags has helped reduce waste. He also explained that possibly creating smaller community waste management sites could create an alternative to having large landfills like Seneca Meadows.
Right now there's a huge push locally for, in upstate New York especially, to take all the organic waste out of the trash stream. So the city of Geneva has a grinder where you can bring, you know, vegetables and eggshells, and then it composts it all. And a lot of municipalities should be doing that on their own. They would be cutting a large percentage of what has to go in any landfill. And if people would just get behind some of those movements, what would the actual landfill capacities would be so diminished that every town could have a small landfill someplace for their own use. Or every four towns get together, or, you know, or in a region. And then they would never get huge, like what we've got across the street.
For now, the town of Seneca will wait for a DEC decision on the application for the landfill's expansion. Churchill encouraged all residents who want to talk about their thoughts on the landfill to come to town board meetings to keep fighting for change.
Very few people come to the town board meetings. I like to get people to come and just get, you know, get up to the podium at the beginning of the meeting, give their name and address, and just say whether, you know, just say something about the landfill, if you're against it or why you're against it. I mean, people really have, I think, given up hope. in a lot of ways. People have grown accustomed to it, right? It's right next door to our Walmart parking lot or business district. And it's frustrating. I mean, I sit on a board where essentially, you know, I got my hands tied now that it's 4-1. I don't know. It wears you down. I mean, I wonder about my future. You know, I mean, I wonder about how long I might even stay here.
Community member and brewery co-owner Anna Luisi talked about her love for the area of Seneca Falls and how important preserving the environment is for the community.
I have always said with Seneca Falls, although it is a small town, it is not isolated. So within an hour, you can be in gorgeous Ithaca, you can be in Rochester, you can be in Syracuse. At 20 minutes on either side is Geneva and Auburn. And then in between all those places are wineries and breweries and beautiful state parks and waterfalls. So in a lot of ways, it's like the best of both worlds, where there's a lot of cultural opportunities and things to do in nature. But you do have that small town feel of knowing people and running into people you know and cultivating really good relationships with your neighbors. There's just so much natural beauty and this beautiful source of fresh water, and I think it's important that we really honor that and try to find sustainable ways to move forward so that we can keep this natural beauty that's so special.
For WICB News, I'm Caroline Grass.
And I'm Joshua Pantano.
You're listening to Ithaca Now. I'm your host, George Christopher. In March, the Reimagining Public Safety Special Committee advanced their recommendations for reforms to public safety and policing in Ithaca. The Special Committee was a do-over of sorts for the Reimagining Public Safety Working Group, which published its own recommendations last year. The Special Committee's recommendations were taken up by the Common Council in early April. I attended the Council's meeting to learn more. Last week, we brought you a story on the Reimagining Public Safety Special Committee. In that story, we covered the recommendations offered by the committee, including a deputy city manager position to oversee public safety and create a pilot program in conjunction with the PBA and the Ithaca Police Department for call types that can be transferred to non-law enforcement officials, the creation of a co-response team to respond to calls with police, increased protections for whistleblowers and resources for the Community Police Board, support improving training to maintain progressive change in the police department, and review structures to provide oversight, including the creation of a public safety committee. This report was significantly different from the original report published by the Reimagining Public Safety Working Group. That report called for a restructuring of the police department and the creation of a new division of unarmed first responders under a city department. That report was steeped in controversy due to an ethics investigation still being conducted by the county and claims by some that the report didn't take in enough input from the police. It should be noted, Acting Police Chief John Jolie, PBA President Thomas Kunzella, and former IPD Lieutenant Scott Gammon were all members of the working group. The working group's report, published last year, was, quote, accepted but not adopted, unquote, by the Common Council. The special committee was made up of common counselors, but several veterans of the working group did contribute to the report. The new report took a significantly more moderate approach than the original working group's. At Wednesday's meeting, members of the public spoke to express their frustrations with the length of the process and the council's unwillingness to pursue the bolder solutions.
And I also want to frame your attention around the fact that, like, this executive order that you guys are executing came out from the governor at the time because police officers are brutalizing, killing, and disproportionately mass incarcerating Black people in America, including in New York, including in Ithaca. We have our own laundry list of incidents, none of which, to any extent that I'm aware, have seen the officers dismissed from the department. And looking at the recommendations that are being considered here, like, and the impetus of this executive order, the core question is, What are you going to do to make sure that this does not happen again? Not what are you going to do to have more data about it when it happens, or have more liability assurance that the person went through X or Y training. What are you going to do to make sure that this does not happen again? Maybe sending some unarmed officers and reducing the number of situations where there's a distressed person and a guy with a gun is going to reduce this. But like, it's been 3 years and we're hearing the same recommendations. And so my question is, like, do we have a problem around this? Like, what's the holdup?
The ask for many in the community are set in stone, however. We demand cutbacks on the number of officers armed with deadly weapons and to reallocate those funds to unarmed crisis responders, affordable housing, and mental health services. Data shows that when all people's needs are met, a community becomes safer for everyone. There needs to be an end to sending armed police to go out to calls and mobile crisis team, especially calls for BIPOC folks, and instead send more team members out with extensive training and provide funding for more supportive services that people actually ask for and need. I work in housing justice and am a tenant myself and would like to have much more affordable quality housing for intensely resource-strapped tenant market that we have here in the city of Ithaca. I also deeply wish for a number to call that would mitigate harm for someone in crisis, not exacerbate it, for professionals and community members who will care and come up with solutions, not violence. As a city that claims to be progressive, we need to stop saying, like, paying lip service to the safety of Black and Brown community members and actually start protecting them.
I can tell you that in 3 years, I feel no more safe. I never called the police. I'm not going to name names because I'm trying to be respectful of the rules of this council meeting, but I've had several run-ins with police that made me realize and make me know even more that I feel less safe. And I don't want any of my people, Black people, calling the police because they're not going to feel any safer. Until we deal with the root causes of police brutality, the root causes of need in this town, right? Outreach, talking about actually getting to the root causes of crime, right? Needs, housing, right? We talked about the housing there, things that can actually make a difference for people. That's where the funding needs to go. And I've seen so many opportunities. I've seen many opportunities squandered and not talked about. I talked about again and again and again. It's the same cycle. I think a lot of people are sick. Thank you.
When it came time for the council itself to take up the report, they explained that there had been changes made between the report's final approval by the Reimagining Public Safety Special Committee and the Common Council meeting. Some changes were banal, including a reordering of the recommendations and changing the name of the crisis co-response team, dropping the word crisis and changing it to simply co-response team. Councilor George McGonigal, a member of the special committee, explained the change.
This was something that the county felt fairly strongly about. We did not call it a crisis co-response team anymore. We're just calling it a co-response team. That's kind of a placeholder, really. The deputy city manager may have ideas about what they want to call this team, or we may want to call it something later, but for now, we're calling it a co-response team.
Other changes included adding, quote, American Indians, unquote, to a list of marginalized groups. Councilor Cynthia Brock, another member of the special committee, also responded to claims that the co-response team may be subject to the same culture as the police department, potentially tainting their role as a counterbalance, and explained the vision for the co-response team.
The co-response team is separate from the police department, would be housed in a different department from the police department. This is not a mental health response. That is being handled by the CJC and the county. That is the county jurisdiction. So it's not a mental health crisis response team, but it is a team that would co-respond with law enforcement to nonviolent call types and be that connection with victims and victims' families to help connect them as needed with services if they need it, whether or not it's social service, family services, to help assist them and be that basically that warm handoff to follow up with them. How are things going? You know, are you connecting with the services you need to try to address issues from that angle? So it's not cahoots, it's not a mental health response. That is something that the county is spearheading. That is their jurisdiction. This is more sort of an interpersonal connection. And we look towards times when there may be times when they can go on their own. There may be times that then if the IPD doesn't need to be there, they will leave, and those individuals would stay behind to help. So that's the vision for that team.
Councillor Brock later explains the move towards a pilot program for non-law enforcement responses rather than more concrete plans by saying the city needs to work collaboratively with the police. Councillor Phoebe Brown seemed to suggest that relationship needs to go both ways.
Working with law enforcement to identify calls that can be responded to by people who are not police officers, we need to work collaboratively with our department in order to identify those call posts.
They have to work collaboratively with us.
Yes, exactly. And this is part of that program.
The council also changed a provision encouraging officers to participate in community events. The new report specifies officers should only participate in, quote, invited events to assuage fear police may encroach on safe spaces for marginalized communities.
One of the public comments was concerned. The item was building relationships with IPD officers and community members and increasing officer participation at community organization events. And the concern was, you know, we don't want to take away safe spaces for individuals in the community.
McGonigal said public comment showed Ithacans wanted an IPD with a more personal connection to the community. But McGonigal also insisted staffing was a constant impediment to so-called community policing.
It was clear, listening to people in the community, that they want IPD to serve their communities and not just come to like a barbecue once a year, but to show an interest in their communities and in their community organizations on an ongoing basis, to get out of their cars, to talk to people, to, as Phoebe says, even when you're understaffed, you can still smile at people and say hello. And that's a big part of what we want. You can't get away from the fact that in order to do good community policing, we can't be down 15 officers. We can't ignore community policing when we're understaffed, but we can do a much better job when we have a full contingent of not just police, but also these co-responders.
Another major change was with regards to the Community Police Board. The report published last month by the Special Committee called for the police chief and officers to be required to participate in CPB investigations and review. However, the report taken up by the committee on Wednesday says that the chief must participate in, quote, CPB meetings and oversight responsibilities. The new report also allows the chief to defer that responsibility to a designee. It doesn't make any requirements of police officers writ large. Another change to this section was in funding for third-party review investigations into police conduct. The original report called for funding to be provided and utilized for third-party review of IPD internal investigations and high-interest or complex community complaints. The new report allows funds to be used for third-party investigations as well as high-profile CPB complaints, but uses the word may, indicating it may be at the discretion of the Common Council. We spoke with McGonigal to explain these changes. He said they came at the behest of the Community Police Board, which didn't want to see their role expanded beyond their means. McGonigal also said the CPB felt that police officers were already willing to participate in investigations, and creating a requirement could have damaged the dynamic between the board and officers.
The only substantive changes in the report were involved the Community Police Board, and those changes were made because the members of the Community Police Board wanted those changes. So the first one you mentioned, which does not require police to participate in an investigation if they don't want to. That was changed because the members of the board felt that it should be a voluntary thing. It's working real well right now. Nobody's refusing to participate. But they felt if it was a requirement, that that would create kind of a different atmosphere, and so that's why we made that change at their recommendation.
The new report allows the funding to be used for third-party investigations, which seems like a significant change as well, as well as high-profile CPB complaints. But the word may is used. Does that indicate that the Common Council has discretion over whether or not to provide those funds? They can, but they can choose not to as well?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, Common Council has the power to release funds for anything or not. And the members of the Community Police Board felt that that was just beyond their scope to call for an independent investigation. They can recommend something like that, but it's ultimately Common Council's job to call for that extra investigation and to pay for it. So that was really a proper change because the CPB, Community Police Board, has a specific undertaking, which is investigating complaints, but not going farther than that. And if it becomes something complex, then council has to deal with that.
During the Common Council's meeting, McGonigal made a final case for the passage of the report and directly responded to the frustrations expressed during the public comment portion.
A lot of people's complained tonight about how slow this process has gone. Once we approve this report, we can get down to business. So I encourage you to vote for it.
However, the council's left wing offered their own proposed change. Councilor Jorge Difendini, supported by Councilor Phoebe Brown, called for language to be added to direct the new Public Safety Committee to study the city of Rochester's Police Accountability Board. After brief confusion, where Councilor McGonigal claimed Difendini's proposal was illegal, seemingly misunderstanding Difendini's proposal, Councilor Rob Gearhart of the 3rd Ward chastised Difendini, saying it was inappropriate to offer such an amendment verbally so late in the meeting.
I just want to talk about this procedurally, because I'm not necessarily saying that the idea isn't worth exploring, but I think we're talking about ways that that can be explored without, at 9:45 at night, adding a verbal, very complex amendment to a resolution that is not friendly to the proposer. So if you want to move that and put it to a vote of this body, we can do that, but that's how this needs to work. And I'm a little nervous to do that kind of complexity in this resolution at 9:45 at night, and we still have executive session ahead of us. So let's also respect the work that our colleagues did to put all of this in writing in front of us so that we could manage the complex changes that were being made to this. Complex may be a strong word, because I think maybe up to George's point, we're not complex, but they were detailed for us to follow. That is not a respectful way to add a complex idea verbally to this and expect us to be able to react to it now.
Councilor McGonigal agreed.
I have no objection to you bringing up this topic in the future, but I do object to you bringing it up at the end of the meeting, and this is what I've heard about it. So that's why I don't support the addition to this.
Ultimately, Difendini withdrew his proposal, saying it was for the sake of continuing the process along. The council adopted the Reimagining Public Safety Special Committee report by a vote of 10-0. With every member voting in the affirmative. The process, which has been underway for years, may finally be at a point where concrete action will be taken. However, whether that action will meet the needs or expectations of Ithacans and grassroots activists has yet to be seen. Reporting for Ithaca Now, I'm George Christopher.
Cornell's Ornithology Lab traces its history back over 100 years, when the university hosted one of the country's first ornithology professors, Arthur A. Allen. Ornithology, the study of birds, remains a crucial part of Cornell's sciences program. WICB correspondent Caroline Grass learned more.
Look at the outer edges of the tail feathers. The downies have...
Ken Hawes, a volunteer leading a beginner bird walk around Sapsucker Woods at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, explained the difference between hairy and downy woodpeckers to the group.
The bill also is larger on the hairy than it is on the downy.
The eight people who attended the walk leaned in to look at his copy of the Peterson Field Guide to Birds as he talked about the birds they were seeing that morning. Every weekend, volunteers from the Cayuga Bird Club run the sessions to educate people and help foster their love of nature and birds.
And typical woodpecker, you know, boop, 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 up the side of the tree.
Haas moved to the Ithaca area 8 years ago and has been part of the Cayuga Bird Club for the last seven. He is now the vice president of the club, and he explained how the Lab of Ornithology is a hub for bird enthusiasts.
It's been kind of a dream come true, because if you're a birder, just about anywhere in the country, but especially in the Northeast, the Lab of Ornithology to me has always been like the mothership. It's the place to go. That's a world-class leading organization coming out with programs and apps like eBird and now Merlin and all of the other things that they do. So it means so much to me to just be a small part of that.
The lab has a mission to, quote, interpret and conserve the Earth's biological diversity through research, education, and citizen science focused on birds. Innovative technologies are developed at the lab to aid in research and conservation efforts that ordinary people can contribute to. The lab is home to the McCulley Library, which is an archive of over 49 million audio, photo, and videos of birds and other wildlife. Since 1929, over 10,000 species of birds have been cataloged through collected media. The data is used by scientists, educators, and have even been used for movies and TV shows. Mike Webster, professor in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell and director of the McCulley Library, explained what the library looks like.
The McCulley Library is an actual place. So we have a space in the building that is the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And inside that space, we have a lot of studios where the staff work to turn raw field recordings of birds and nature into what we call video specimens. So every recording we think of as a specimen, very much like any other biological museum, except for in most museums, the specimens that they have are bones and feathers and things like that. Our specimens are all recordings, and they capture the voices of animals, the behavior of animals, the signals of animals. And then we have a room that is full of old reel-to-reel tapes and cassette tapes. That is our storage for the old collection, which was started back in 1929. And so all of the first several decades of the collection were on tape, and they're all stored back there, but now we've digitized them, and now all of the recordings that come in are digital. They're not on tape anymore. Most of the recordings are actually up in the cloud. So when you access McCulley Library online, you're actually tapping into the cloud and hearing our recordings that are stored up there.
Anyone can upload media to be archived through eBird, which is a website where over 870,000 people log their bird sightings.
That's our citizen science, like, bird sightings project. It's a global database of, you know, kind of the checklists of birds that people have seen at different spots. And we're using that for all sorts of cool kind of studies on and research on bird populations and trends. And with each of these checklists, the users can upload photos of the birds, sounds of the birds, and videos. And then all of that gets housed in the McCulley Library. The cool thing is it's like also this community contributed resource of like over a million recordings that are powering this.
That was Drew Weber, who is the Merlin project manager at the lab. Launched in 2014, Merlin Bird ID is an app that helps birders identify the birds they see. The app asks the color, size, and behavior of the bird that was seen and will help give possible options to what the bird could be. In 2017, the app was expanded with Photo ID, where users can snap a photo and the app will identify the bird. And in 2021, Sound ID was released.
It actually started off as a very simple app. It covered 285 species, which were for the US and Canada, which is like some of the most common species that you'd find in your backyard, but not like very comprehensive. In 2016, we started expanding more globally. And so we added, you know, a lot, basically completed coverage for the US and Canada. So now we have, you know, 900 species covered. We expanded it to Mexico and kind of like continued down through Central and South America and the rest of the world. And actually just this month, a week ago, we released kind of the last bird packs that we're going to release. Like we basically covered all the birds of the world that we have content for.
Under the Sound ID feature, users can start an audio recording and the app will identify the birds it hears in real time. Weber said that the Sound ID feature has driven the expansion of Merlin to a wider audience. In regions with Sound ID, Weber said that currently over 300,000 people use Sound ID in a day, and that he expects the usage to grow in the coming months when birdsong is at its peak.
That was actually a really fun project to get started on because it hadn't really been done in the way we wanted to do it, which was showing kind of live identifications to you as you're hearing the birds and just kind of like continuing to show those identifications over and over. So that, you know, as you're listening to the birds, as you're seeing the interface kind of flash the answers up to you, you can like start to learn like, oh, this is what a song sparrow sounds like. This is what a house finch sounds like. And Sound ID has been super successful. We've expanded that to basically all the birds of US and Canada, as well as Europe. And then we have kind of like widespread species covered for parts of Asia, specifically India and Central and South America. One of the huge challenges for us is we need at least 100 good sound recordings of each species to really get the kind of like variation and repertoire into the machine learning model. And so we're still working with, you know, communities across the world to build up enough of an audio collection that we can, you know, continue to expand Sound ID.
Stephanie Herrick, president of the Cayuga Bird Club, said she loves to use the technology of Merlin, which helps her identify birds.
That technology is so cool. And one of the things, I work at Cornell, one of the things that I got to engage in was the very early teaching of Merlin. So when they were designing the software, they had to figure out, well, how do people identify birds? And that's how they came up with that list of questions that they ask in the identify the bird button, that first button that you see in Merlin. So that was fun seeing Merlin at its very beginning and see it change. I use Merlin most of the times that I go out, and even sometimes just standing in my backyard to see, hey, is anybody new showing up? I've fed it pictures of birds that I've seen around my feeder area where I thought, why is that on my feeder? That can't be what I think it is. And the photo ID will identify it for me.
A 2019 study from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, American Bird Conservancy, and other groups found that 2.9 billion birds in North America were gone from 1970. In the last 50 years, forests lost 1 billion birds, and bird populations in grasslands were found to have declined by 53%. The study also found that 2.5 of the 2.9 billion birds, or 90%, lost were from the 12 common families, including sparrows, blackbirds, and finches. The first step to helping preserve bird populations is knowing where existing populations are. Webster talked about how monitoring birds can help scientists understand how larger ecosystems are faring.
I'm passionate about saying birds just because I love them. They're just amazing animals. But birds are also very useful. They're a lot more visible, and they do sing. They make a lot of noise. So it's easier to notice birds and to monitor their populations and to survey them than it is for like lizards or most mammals, for example, are nocturnal. They're out at night and they slink around under the grass and you don't see them. So they're very hard to monitor. But birds are out there at the day. They're singing, they're vocalizing, they're making a lot of noise. They're often very colorful and easy to spot. And they do serve as sort of a canary in a coal mine also because they are sensitive to environmental perturbations. And so by monitoring how birds are doing, we can get a sense of how the whole ecosystem is doing.
Weber talked about how data on birds can help people better understand the area around them on both a small and large scale.
we've been developing these kind of map products that show like each month of the year where birds are predicted to be. And so that's useful for like people who want to develop their land or preserve their land for, you know, increased biodiversity. It helps them understand what birds should be in their area. And we can also use this data to see the trends of birds over the past like 10, 20 years now that we've been collecting this data. And so you can see, you know, where wood thrush, for example, is really declining or where it's really recovering. And this is also helpful for both like landowners and nonprofits to kind of understand what's going on in their backyard. But it's also been used by government agencies to track, you know, how the health of the birds are going. And there's a kind of a lot of like different ways you can use that data, either on like a really small scale, like trying to plant native plants in your gardens to increase bird diversity in your backyard, all the way up to like, you know, U.S. and Fish and Wildlife Service managing the refuges and understanding the timing of different birds coming through and when they'd want to close certain areas and that sort of thing.
Much of the data for analysis comes from citizen scientists who record species in their own backyard. Webster said outreach and education is important to get people interested about birds, which in turn helps conservation efforts.
It's critically important to educate people about birds and to get them interested in birds and get them engaged with birds, because people will only preserve what they love. And by helping people understand birds and understand how amazing they are, and how they are a great entry point into just appreciating nature in general, we're helping people care about those environments that need saving. And that's a critically important step in making conservation happen. The Moncalie Library exists because of the really dedicated efforts of a lot of enthusiastic bird recordists. You know, we don't pay people to run around the world and record birds. These recordings are coming from people who just like doing it and have liked doing it for decades. And, you know, if it weren't for them contributing all of their recordings that they go out of their way to make and work really hard to get really good recording of species that are difficult to record, if it weren't for them, we wouldn't exist. And I really appreciate those efforts of all those dedicated bird watchers and bird recordists who just love doing this kind of work.
The Cayuga Bird Club has helped foster people's love for birds for the last 110 years. The club has over 300 members and holds monthly meetings and invites guest speakers to talk. They also host bird walks and field trips, and they help maintain and preserve natural lands in the southern end of Cayuga Lake through the work of their Conservation Action Committee. The club focuses its work around three main objectives: conservation, education, and appreciation. The club accepts anyone with any skill level, and Herrick emphasized that birding is for everyone.
And one of the first things I ask people is, do you like birds? Do you enjoy seeing birds? Do you have fun learning more about birds? And they usually answer yes, yes, yes. I said, well, then you're a birder. You don't have to have a life list this long and a scope this large. And you're a birder. Birds are bellwethers of sorts, where we've seen billions of birds disappear over the years. And that is telling in terms of what we're doing to the planet that we all inhabit. So by getting people to appreciate birds at any age also gets them to appreciate the environment that we're all living in together. So one of the things that I've noticed about myself is that when I got involved with the bird club, I really have only been in the club for about 3 going on 4 years, I suddenly became very interested in habitat improvement. So I've been quite active with many others on our Conservation Action Committee. We engage local schools to bring kids out to do these habitat improvement projects and go birding so that they can see why they're engaged in this work.
Haas said that people from all over the world attend the bird walks at the lab in addition to locals, and he recounted a memory where families were translating the knowledge he was sharing into different languages for their family members. He said the experience of sharing his knowledge is rewarding, and he loves that these walks and the work of the Lab of Ornithology can help people appreciate the world around them.
And I'm thinking to myself, this is great. Look what I'm doing here. I'm helping these people to appreciate the outdoors, to learn about birds, and if I'm lucky, they'll go and spread that word to their other family members, friends all over the world. And it seems that everybody in any part of the world has a fascination about birds. And if they have just an inkling in interest and they come here, it'll just fan that flame.
For WICB News, I'm Caroline Grass.
That's all for this week's Ithaca Now. You can listen to all of our stories on WICB.org, and if you'd like to listen to past shows, follow WICB on SoundCloud and subscribe to Ithaca Now to hear this show anywhere, anytime. Also, subscribe to The Latest to hear our daily newscast every weekday. Just search WICB News Presents on your favorite podcast app. For more updates throughout the week, follow WICB News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. This show wouldn't happen without the support and assistance from Manager of Television and Radio Operations Jeremy Menard, WICB Station Manager Connor Hibbard, and Programming Director Harrison Kona. Thank you. Ithaca Now is produced by News Director George Christopher, with assistance from News Production Director Liam McDermott, Web Coordinator Inbaini Ambarasan, and our Social Media Coordinator Chess Cabrera. All of the music from our show's intro and outro comes from Dr. Dundiff of Louisville, Kentucky. Have any feedback, story ideas, just want to say hi, feel free to reach out by emailing news@wicb.org. We will be back with a new season of Ithaca Now in August.